This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello, this is the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast from Literary Hub, where we believe that every issue in your social media feed or on the evening news has already been tackled somewhere in literature. I'm Whitney Terrell, the author of the novel The Good Lieutenant.
And I'm Vivi Ganeshanathan, also known as Sugi, author of the novel Brotherless Night.
So, not to bring up a boring topic, but or maybe it's not boring. How's the weather up there in Minneapolis? We've been like doing some crazy stuff here. It's like 20 degrees one day, 80 degrees another day. Winter wasn't really all that harsh, but then also we had snow on the ground for a long period of time, longer than usual. It's been crazy stuff.
Are we reducing ourselves to small talk about the weather? Okay. No, actually, I take that back. I think the weather is definitely not small talk anymore. We had here also wild temperature swings, and it's awful. We had we had hardly any snow. I'm used to a lot of snow.
What?
It turns out I like snow, I miss snow, I want snow. And change...
Doesn't your dog wear those little booty things that you take?
She did.
Is it a him or her? And now yes, that's right.
Her pronouns are she, her. Sorry. And she normally wears little booties that are very hard to put on. And this year she hardly ever had to put them on, which was convenient and alarming. And these sorts of changes and more serious changes are, of course, not just hitting the Midwest. Do you remember when I was in Florida at that residency?
Yeah, that was like 5 years ago. At that time, we were interviewing Emily Rabiteau and Omar Ellicott about climate change.
And yeah, during that interview, you kept saying the residency was going to be hit in some way by like a natural disaster or something. And in 2022, it was. By Hurricane Ian, a Category 5 hurricane.
I did want that to be a joke. I didn't want to be right.
Well, you were right. And because it's always time to talk about climate change, today we're doing it again. And we're bringing Emily Rabiteau back with her new collection of essays, Lessons for Survival, Mothering Against the Apocalypse. Emily's previous books are Searching for Zion, winner of an American Book Award, and the novel The Professor's Daughter. A contributing editor at Orion Magazine and a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books, Emily has published essays and been anthologized in The New Yorker, The New York Times, New York Magazine, The Nation, Best American Science Writing, Best American Travel Writing, and elsewhere. Among many other distinctions, she is the recipient of an inaugural Climate Narratives Prize from Arizona State University. She is a street photographer and professor of creative writing at the City College of New York, CUNY, in Harlem. She lives in the Bronx with her husband, the novelist Victor Laval, and their two children. Emily, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the last time you were here in 2019, when we were still, I think, using Skype, you talked about Climate Signs, a piece you'd written for the New York Review of Books website, prompted in part by an art project featuring actual signs about the climate crisis. A version of that piece is part of this new book, which is out this week. You've been writing about climate change not only as something that affects our geography, but also our social and political climates. And as I was reading, I was thinking about our ability to care and hope and the way that connects to knowledge. You started writing about the climate crisis after the release of the 2018 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which you mentioned in the book. How did that report lead you to write about climate change through the lens of mothering?
Well, I didn't read the IPCC report that year. I have read it in years since. What I read was an analysis of it, or kind of like a summary description of it, like a translation of it, by David Wallace Wells, which ran in New York Magazine, and then became the genesis of his book that came out later called Uninhabitable Earth. And that piece by David, along with a lot of other media that came out in 2018 after the publication of that report, had a different kind of language. It was, you know, suddenly there was a lot more acknowledgement of extreme danger than had previously existed in media. And I think journalists had been kind of warned against sounding alarmist, and suddenly I don't know what changed, but there was a real change in the tenor of the way the science was being translated to readers. So I already was on this heightened state of alarm, honestly, as a mother, thinking, all right, if things are as bad as David Wallace Wells has just made them seem after reading this report, then we're really in trouble. My children are really in trouble, and I'm quite scared for them. And it was in that context of a sudden new kind of awareness of the level of danger that I came across a sign in a park in my neighborhood that I think I might not have noticed otherwise, which was a public artwork I talked with you guys about this last time, that was the purpose of which was to make New Yorkers in particular confront the dangers posed to the city by climate change, not as a future eventuality, but as a current threat. And I took seriously the artist's desire, which was for me, you know, as somebody who lives in the city, to reckon with that. And I ended up writing about it.
I remember, and so for our listeners who didn't hear the previous conversation, we'll put that in our show notes for you so you can go back and listen to it. I remember that one of your kids, maybe your older child, interviewed David Wallace Wells and had a conversation that you had set up. And I remember being so impressed by the questions, that little exchange. And how are your kids thinking about climate change these days?
Yeah, that was Geronimo when he was 7. He's about to turn 13 now. And, you know, I wanted him to have the opportunity to ask questions of somebody who is more expert than myself about his growing fears and anxiety about the climate crisis. And one of his questions was, you know, where should I live? Where is it safe to live? Will the world be around when I'm a grown-up? Something like that was another one of his questions. Will the whales be okay? So sweet. I mean, some of his questions were questions an adult would have, and some of them were particular to his, you know, 7-year-old self. And I just want to say David Wallace Wells, I thought, did an excellent job altering his language for a child. You know, the uninhabitable earth was... The language was extremely, and one might say, like, appropriately alarmist, and it wouldn't have been the right kind of language to use with a 7-year-old. And so his level of attunement and adjustment was really humane. And I also learned from him and a lot of other people since that time about how to talk to kids about the climate crisis in age-appropriate terms and in direct answer to questions that they're bringing me, as opposed to talking about it in ways they may not be ready for yet. You asked how they're doing with it now. Yeah, my kids are 11 and 12, almost 13. And this is part of their reality. They're Generation Alpha. Our generation, I'm Generation X. Like, we've been described as the last generation that can stop climate change. That's a lot of weight on our shoulders, and it's a lot of pressure on our children. So I think working through it, you know, talking to them, I often think of what Mr. Rogers used to say, like, look for the helpers is a useful way to talk about it with my kids. One thing that's going on in our neighborhood right now in the Bronx is that they're daylighting a stream, which means they're unburying a stream that was buried a long time ago as a climate mitigation effort. And it's happening right here, you know, like a few blocks from us. And so we're able to talk about that, why it was buried in the first place, why unburying it is going to help, how that relates to climate change, and who's been involved in that effort. It's a lot of people from our community. So, you know, I'm trying to make it concrete for them, even in terms of making them understand the possibility of careers in sustainability, right? Thinking in solutions-oriented terms instead of merely apocalyptic terms.
That's something that I think about a lot because I have kids as well, and my youngest is 14 and my oldest is 18. And, you know, I also want to try to have them be able to relate to nature, not only in terms of like, this is a disaster, right? I want them to be able to have positive interactions with it, to love it and care for it, you know, without always having to think about its danger. I used to fish in Alaska up in Ketchikan, and you have some writing about Alaska in the current book. And I took them up there this summer to the place where I used to fish because the fishing industry is pretty sustainable up there. And I thought it would be a way to like show them the sort of, I mean, the territory around Ketchikan is incredibly beautiful. And yet the ocean was warmer than it had been when I was there. People were swimming in it, which nobody did when I had last been there. The salmon wow. runs were affected. It was really kind of inescapable, you know, that you felt the climate change. Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
I hear you, Whitney, and both the drive to find solace in nature for your kids, to connect them to it so they don't think of it as merely being disastrous, but rather something that a disaster was done to, but nevertheless still something, you know, that can offer solace and beauty. I went on a trip that reminds me of what you just described with my younger child last spring? It was when we had this huge wildfire event with the smoke coming down from Canada. And you may remember there was media of, you know, you couldn't even see the Statue of Liberty or closer to where we live, the George Washington Bridge, the sky was orange. And I had arranged this camping trip through the Appalachian Mountain Club months in advance with my kid, thinking, I got to get them out of the city. We're going to kayak in the lake. We're going to find peace in the forest. And it coincided with the worst wildfire smoke event in U.S. history. And we all, you know, I picked up my child. We had to pick them up early from school because it was an emergency. And we were getting alarms on our phones. We had to pull out the masks that we had put away from the pandemic. Then when, you know, the like air quality slid from red, which is hazardous, to orange, and then to like high yellow into like the moderate range, I thought, okay, maybe now it's safe to take them. And when we arrived at the campsite, the air smelled of smoke, it smelled like a campfire, even though nobody had fires going and you couldn't see across the lake. It was so hazy. And my question as a parent was, have I done the right thing? Is it actually dangerous to be exposing them? Is this air is toxic? And yet my impulse was to detoxify. It's a very bewildering moment.
I remember that's what that smoke was like here too. And I mean, so much of what we're talking about maybe a little bit is a struggle for language to put to this. You were talking earlier about how to explain it to children. David Boswell's adjusting his language and you learning to adjust yours. I think one of the things that I most appreciate in your book is the way that the form of the book represents the complexity of the conversation, and also how terms that I associate with certain arenas of discourse, you teach me to see in new and more expansive ways how they connect to climate. So, for example, other people have also used some of these terms in this way, like the use of the term reparations. And then very early on in the book, there's an essay called Caution, in which you write about your health and being sick and being a disbelieved, gaslit woman patient, and the kind of incessant parade of microaggressions that you experience. And I'm quoting here, death by a million microaggressions, by racism, by air pollution and the urban heat island effect, by disillusionment and the disintegration of kinship structures, by the police, by the man, by the world of men, by the weight of my grandmother's sorrow and the threat of the rising sea, by the needs of my needy children, by America, death by the wolf of debt, a slow, inglorious death. And when I think of microaggressions, I think my first association is racial microaggressions. And probably that's probably true for many other people. And I think of my parents and friends and teachers teaching me how to handle myself in relation to those things and teaching me how to handle those microaggressions. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about microaggressions in the environment, learning how to respond.
Thanks for that question. I did use the word microaggressions in that excerpt you just read, which is pretty dark. And hearing you read it, I wonder if it's the right term even. We're looking for terms and we're finding terms that maybe we find in different discourses that are sometimes appropriate and maybe not quite. Like, we're being invited, I think, to look for new terms and invent new words and reach for words and other discourses too. Like, so microaggressions are, you know, they're indirect, subtle, or unintentional acts of discrimination against members of marginalized groups. So, for example, a microaggression I grew up with as a person of mixed race, a Black identifying person of mixed race who is racially ambiguous visually, was, what are you? It's like a question I received almost every day of my childhood. What are you, right? Which over time felt really hard, like aggression. And those are the kind of remarks that are really painful because they have to do with a person's membership in a group that's subject to stereotypes or misunderstanding, right? But when we think about the environment, I'm wondering if macroaggression or just straight up aggression is a better way of thinking about it, right? I mean, a macroaggression is an act of racism toward everyone of a race or a gender or a group. And so when, you know, I'm looking at things in this book, like the fact that Black Americans are 75% more likely than other Americans to live in fence line communities sited near facilities producing hazardous waste. Is that a microaggression or is that straight up aggression? Or is it long-term systemic something else, right? I don't know. Like, I'm also thinking about things like in that essay you mentioned, Caution, toward the beginning of the book about racial disparities in terms of health. When we think about maternal health mortality, and it's the case that Black women are three times as likely to die from pregnancy-related causes as white women in the U.S., I don't feel like that's microaggression. You know, it's systemic. So I came to learn more and more in the research and writing of this book about environmental racism. And again, you know, like you were asking about it at the beginning, Whitney, it's come from the concerns of motherhood. Like, my kids have asthma because we live in a frontline community encircled by highways, which also, when we're thinking about environments, have been weaponized against Black and brown communities, often to force segregation. Oh, hi, Geronimo. That's the kid who talked to David Wallace Wells. I'm doing an interview, buddy. Why don't you say hi and then give me some space? I actually like that little interruption. Just so you can see, he's like he's growing. Like, then there's, it's so joyful. This is like hard stuff too, but like the silliness and the joy with, like, you know, we just want them to thrive. And so looking at environmental racism and thinking about it, it's like not a fun subject, but it's something I've had to think about because it, you know, affects the health of my kids, that, you know, where they were born. And, you know, we live in Washington Heights. There's all these, when we lived in Washington Heights, which is where they were born, the percentage of children who suffered from asthma because of the highways encircling our community and the George Washington Bridge, which is the most heavily trafficked bridge in the world, being right there, and the bus depot that's right there, and the wastewater treatment plant that's not far away. Like, it's no accident that those things are placed where they are. And we moved to the Bronx to get away from some of those things during the pandemic, unknowingly moving into another community that suffers from some of the same problems or similar ones, right? So I'm just trying to, you know, think through this. Like, your question about microaggressions is making me think that wasn't even the right term. I mean, what if you're one of these people who live near these, you know, these factory farms where they have like pigs, thousands of pigs, and your house is being rained down upon by a combination of their blood and feces and piss. Like, is that a microaggression? No.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here and we'll be right back.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Well, in addition to writing about your children, there's a lot of writing in this book about other members of your family and ancestors. Would you read us a section about that?
Yeah, I will. This is from a part of the book. This is from the eponymous essay, Lessons in Survival. I'll just set it up by saying that this grew out of a essay/review that I wrote for the New York Review of Books, which was looking at Elizabeth Rush's book, Rising, which is about sea level rise. And as I was reading it, you know, and learning from her book about the strategy of managed retreat, which is a way of communally leaving a threatened, you know, shoreline community with government funding in a way that takes a lot of labor and work, but is an effort to survive, rather than like building back a home that's been flooded by, in let's say a hurricane. She's talking about how we need to think about managed retreat more and more as the threat of sea level rise increases, as the ice caps melt. And I couldn't help thinking of my grandmother as I was reading her book. I hope that this section will explain why. My grandmother, Maybelle Sincere Robiteau, fled the coastal town of Bay St. Louis, Mississippi, in the terror of Jim Crow, along the northern pathway of the Great Migration to Michigan, in order to save her life and the lives of her children. The youngest of them was my father, Albert Robiteau Jr. He was still in her womb when a white man shot and killed her husband, my grandfather, practically for sport. I probably don't need to tell you that Albert Sr.'s murderer went scot-free. The details are fuzzy. The man's name was Summerall. He owned the ice house in the bay. A fight had gone down in the ice house. Maybelle's friend, Nini, was threatened. My grandfather went to Summerall's house to confront him. Summerall wasn't home, but his wife was. She relayed my grandfather's anger to her husband. The next day, Summerall went to the grocery store where my grandfather worked as a clerk and shot him to death. There were no witnesses. Summerall was arrested. He claimed self-defense. He was not prosecuted. With such ease was my grandfather dispatched down south in 1943. The courage it took Maybelle to escape from harm's way and start her life over was no less extraordinary for being such an ordinary African-American story. Her fugitive ways were also the gift of improvisation, the same kind of talent that could draw low-down music out of an upside-down bucket, rigged with the handle of a broom and a single string. What other gut bucket choice did she have but this? As Mary Anais Heglar points out in her vital essay, climate change ain't the first existential threat. There's a short-sighted arrogance to the environmental movement when it claims ours is the first generation in history to face annihilation. Faced with the horrors of climate change, how do we define or redefine the term resilience? What do we mean when we name a person, place, or thing resilient? When I hear that word, I can't help thinking of my grandmother and of both the Great Migration and the Underground Railroad as prior examples of organized retreat, albeit from a different hazard to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness than the rising sea. Public art in the form of climate signs has made me reckon with the existential and financial threat posed to the United States coastline by sea level rise. I'd followed the signs out to Staten Island, where a managed retreat has taken place with my friend Mick. Some folks consider managed retreat to be our best defense, given the scale of the problem. This approach calls for withdrawing rather than rebuilding after disasters, and would include government buyout programs to finance the resettlement of homeowners from vulnerable areas. Of course, the climate crisis has worsened in the short time since Mick and I wandered the city, pointing to the challenge of a story that cannot keep pace with its subject. The picture is moving at too many frames per second. In August 2019, Indonesia announced plans to change its capital to Borneo from Jakarta, which is sinking beneath the sea. That same year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released a new report showing that low-lying coastal zones, home to 680 million people, about 10% of the world's population, are at severe risk of increased sea level rise, extreme weather, and more frequent and stronger storms. More than half the world's megacities and 1.9 billion people living on the world's coasts are in grave danger, and several cities are already disappearing underwater. New York is the center of my universe, but this is not only a New York story. It's Mick who taught me that sometimes the clearer picture is the one where the camera's pulled back. I want my eye to be big, like the eye of the woman in the Bushwick mural. Is there a wide enough aperture to show what the climate emergency looks like now? Or is the trick to look at the past? How do we ensure that a strategy like managed retreat doesn't result in unjust displacement? There is a pernicious history in this country of the forced movement of people of color, from chattel slavery and Native American removal to Japanese American internment camps, segregation, redlining, urban renewal, slum clearance, and real estate exploitation. Given our track record, it wasn't surprising to learn from a report in the journal Science Advances that the selection of properties for federal buyouts among the homes in flood-prone areas bought and demolished by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, in the last 20 years had as much to do with income as danger. The factor should be danger.
Thank you very much. This is a great essay, and it's the title essay of the book, as you mentioned. Could you talk a little bit about this idea of how your different identities as a Black woman and a mother, among other things, brought you to these questions of resilience and how to think about resilience in the face of climate change, looking at other examples of resilience from the past?
Yeah, I just learned another way of thinking about resilience from this writer, Anya Kamenetz, who, she doesn't like the term resilience. I don't mind the term, but she suggested we think about that idea instead as like trauma-informed growth, because resilience suggests to me like bouncing back from something, whereas thinking about trauma-informed growth maybe suggests something slightly different. But yeah, like the reason I thought of my grandmother, like maybe that was a strange association, and I was really glad that the New York Review of Books let me write as much as I did about my grandma and what was supposed to be a book review about sea level rise, like a book of science, right? Of incredible environmental reporting by Elizabeth Rush. I felt invited to do that, and you know, because she was such a resilient person, and resilience is something we're being encouraged to think about. But when we're only thinking about it in terms of finance, in terms of, you know, economic recovery, or in terms of something like architecture, and we're not paying attention to resilience in more, I would say, spiritual and emotional terms, and we're not, you know, also backward looking in addition to forward thinking, then I think we're missing out on important lessons. And yeah, the reason I brought up Mary Anais Heglar's important essay, where she reminds us that this isn't the first existential threat people have faced, it's also an instruction to look at, you know, folks who really have something to say about resilience and survival, and to look to those folks in these times.
I agree with you that the more important aspects of surviving this are going to be the human ones. But when you're reading that essay and you're talking about managed retreat from coastal areas, what I think about also is the last financial crisis, right, in 2008, where many, many homes suddenly didn't have the value that the banks thought that they had, that they lent money on. They weren't going to receive payments, and suddenly the banking system seems like it's going to collapse. Isn't this the same thing that's going to happen with coastal properties? I mean, they are overvalued right now. And if there's going to be a managed retreat from them, banks are going to own a lot of paper that is going to be worthless.
Yeah. And what's so disturbing, Whitney, is how much growth is still happening. You know, I mean, we see it here in New York, you see it in Florida, like it's not, the pace is not decreasing, which is insane. And I think, it's not only insane, it's evil. I get, because they do know. But I think we're thinking in terms of like, the length of a mortgage as opposed to like death at a mass scale, you know, the problem here, again, when we're talking about this, is not microaggressions. We're talking about, you know, the other being done and enacted to the environment in this sort of capital framework, where you're going to keep growth at the pace that it is in coastal communities. We need to stop thinking in those terms.
Okay, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
It seems like one of the other things you write about in this essay, you also write about Harriet Tubman, and you write about the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad State Park and Visitor Center, which is in Maryland, where I'm from. And you talk about the fact that the marsh grasses have sensibly retreated to higher ground to survive the water's rise at that site. And you also talk about Harriet Tubman herself as like someone who's was engaged in managed retreat, which was a really helpful comparison for me to think about. Like, what is that? How would that work? And then also, it seems to me like the distinction that you were drawing earlier, like what Anya Kamenetz said about resilience I mean, I also sometimes bristle at that resilience language because I feel like it's also a coded way for someone to be like, it's okay that something unjust was done to you. Look at how strong you are. I'm like, I don't really want to be strong at this particular time. I'd like to curl into a ball and be left alone, you know? And it's often language that's aimed specifically at Black women and other women of color. Like, oh, you're so strong and competent, which is like also a way of veiling that the trauma that you that's in the other phrase, the trauma enforced language. But maybe another way to think about it is like, how can we expand our notions of resilience? And the essay makes a great argument for just sort of managed retreat as a form of resilience, as a strong thing to do, right? That running from threat is an intelligent survival tactic, and that maybe we live in a culture where running is kind of shamed. And here are some examples of strong people who ran. And just as a Marylander, as someone who writes about Sri Lanka and kind of watched the tsunami, the Indian Ocean tsunami, I those were the things that I was thinking about as I read. And I was shocked to realize that the Harriet Tubman site is going to be flooded. And then I thought, of course.
Yeah, it's really sad because it's an important site. And at the same time, how much sense does it make to spend as much money as was spent to memorialize somebody who needs to be memorialized in a place that we all know, you know, if we're paying attention, is going to be underwater soon, you know, maybe sooner than any of us would like to admit. I've thought that too about this, and you know, on the one hand, the fact that they're daylighting this brook in our neighborhood as a work of climate mitigation and, you know, this big green, wonderful thing. I've also wondered, is this the right use of money, of many millions of dollars, when maybe what that money should be spent on is some form of managed retreat, preparation for managed retreat from these neighborhoods, right? From this neighborhood that chronically floods. I read this book and reviewed this book called Charleston, which is about, you know, it's a really, I've never visited there, but it's a really flooded, like chronically flooded city. And Susan Crawford wrote that book. And that's something she questions, like how much does it make sense to spend so much money making this resilient, that word again, right? When maybe resilience looks more like running. Yeah. But I also talked to some indigenous peoples in this book who had like kind of a different strategy of thinking, right? And this might depend on environment, but like another strategy is staying and fighting, right? Like if it's not the sea that we're talking about, the sea that's threatening you, you can't fight water. But you can fight a pipeline, you know, you can fight settler colonialists. So I just want to point out that there are different strategies of resilience that make sense in different circumstances. And I was interested in paying attention to those, too, in this book.
So your book has many wonderful recurring characters that appear in different essays. One, your friend Mick, who we just heard about, Justin Guarilio, whose climate artwork kind of prompted that climate science essay. But I think maybe one of my favorite characters in your book is your father, Albert Rabiteau II, who you've described in your acknowledgments as your muse. And in an essay late in the book, Gut Bucket, you write about him and his passing and, quote, the rituals that protect a soul's core from getting snuffed out by evil forces putting profit above life. Your father was a professor of African and African-American religion, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what role he played and faith plays in the writing of this book.
Thanks for that question. I'm always glad to talk about my dad, who died a couple years ago. I really miss him. And just like to tie my thinking about him to, and my lessons from him to what we've been talking about, you know, like an example of putting profit before life is erecting a building in a, you know, erecting a high-rise building in a threatened community, right? In a community threatened by sea level rise. That's an example of putting profit before life. My dad was a scholar of African American religion. He, was part of a generation of scholars that really started the field of Black studies. It's almost hard for us to imagine now that, you know, Black history wasn't a subject. It wasn't it wasn't something people studied at university. And my dad wrote this really seminal text called Slave Religion. It was actually his dissertation, and he wrote it at the desk I'm sitting at right now talking to you. And he was really interested in looking at, you know, his sources for that book were the voices of people who had been enslaved, who were recorded during the Works Progress Administration. Like, he listened to those tapes of those voices. And they were often talking about resilience, if that's the right word. Is not a word I think you would have found them using, but, what enabled them to survive was often spirituality and expressed in community. And he was really interested in writing about what he called Africanisms, the retentions that survived the lacuna of the Middle Passage that didn't get obliterated during slavery. And the gut bucket is an example of one of those. That's a word we've used a couple times in this conversation that's come up, right? I love that word and I love that thing, which is like an instrument. You know, it's part of the blues and it's just an upside down like bucket with a mop handle and a string that makes music. And it's a retention because it's similar to instruments you find in West Africa, as is the music that comes out of such a simple instrument. So yeah, I think, you know, he was really interested in the best of us, the things that can't be killed, the things that survive. And so,
and you were also juxtaposing that part of his life and teachings with the indigenous people that you visited in Alaska. I wondered if you could talk about, because those are put together in the essay, and I wondered if you could talk about that part of that essay as well.
Yeah, I called that essay Gut Bucket, and I was able to go to coastal Alaska with a colleague of mine who's an earth and atmospheric scientist who's financed by NASA. She studies from space, like what's happening because of climate change to delta systems. And, you know, we were in the Arctic together and she's and her team are gathering water samples. And I was talking to elder indigenous people from that community, Yupik people, about the changes they've noticed to their land and their water in their lifetimes. Like, even you said this, Whitney, even in your own lifetime, like, you've seen changes to Alaska, right?
Yeah.
And these are older people.
I mean, it used to be too cold to swim in the water up there. When I was there in 91 was really probably the last time that I went up there before this summer. And we went up there and you saw people swimming. And, you know, it wouldn't be sunny. It was sunny for 7 days in a row. I don't ever remember that happening in Ketchikan when I was there.
Wow. Yeah. So these Yupik elders were also remembering before warming began, the time when you would, you know, fish or hunt and keep your game below the earth to keep it cold because there was such a thing called permafrost. And now they don't do that anymore because you can't freeze your food that way, right? It's going to start rotting and their houses are shifting and sinking into the Yukon River and all manner of change, right? And I guess the sort of cultural tie I was trying to make between those peoples and my father and his ancestors was, you know, how do we survive this? And also, what do we do with our anger over this so that it doesn't kill us? And one of those elders said something to me that, like, in anyone else's mouth might have sounded trite, but after long conversations about, you know, survival and spirituality, he said, you know, how we don't let our anger kill us is we take care of each other, which really accorded with me too, just cycling back to this thinking about mothering as a stance that I, you know, I think has a lot of revolutionary possibility and potential and always has, like that level of care, that kind of what I call even in the book as like a hyper object, the like mother love to me is a hyper object. And climate change has also been described that way. I'm really interested in this book in thinking about care as the antidote to the violence that's led to the climate crisis.
Emily, congratulations. It's a beautiful book. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, don't miss Lessons for Survival, Mothering Against the Apocalypse, and Emily's other books, which are available in your local independent bookstore.
That's it for the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast. This podcast is produced by Anne Kniggendorf. Our theme music is composed by Travis Workman. You can subscribe to us by typing fiction/non/fiction into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Please go give us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you haven't done it yet. You can also listen, find previous episodes, and read excerpts from our interviews at the Literary Hub website, lithub.com, where the Fiction Nonfiction Podcast page is listed under the Lit Hub Radio tab. We'll also post that show page with links to the books we referenced this week on Facebook at FNF Pod, on Twitter at FNF Talk, on Instagram at fiction.non.fiction.podcast. You can find video of our interviews at our own Fiction Nonfiction Podcast YouTube channel and IGTV channel, and on our website at fnfpodcast.net, where our back episodes are grouped by topic areas. Happy reading!